Thank you. Please be seated. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Farm Bureau Mutual Insurance Companies versus Sears.
May it please the court, Mr. David Beck will present argument for petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. We raise essentially two fundamental points in this proceeding. The first is that the majority of the Court of Appeals created a cause of action for negligent investigation based upon the foreseeable risk that an at-will employee could lose his job. We respectfully submit that that decision represents bad law, and if it is not corrected, it can seriously erode the at-will doctrine in the state of Texas. The second fundamental point we raise is that the majority of the Court of Appeals compounded the error by concluding that by reporting the results of the investigation that was done to authorities that have an interest in the type of conduct that was being investigated constituted outrageous and extreme conduct, one of the elements of the intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action that they alleged.
Now, let me ask you on that point. The record seems to indicate that, yes, there was some post-firing reporting that went to the IRS, I believe, and different federal agencies. But there's also a statement in the Court of Appeals opinion that a trip was made to try to get his license revoked. Now, that seems to be a bit of a different thing than just reporting to federal agencies.
Your Honor, I tried to find where in the transcript there was support for that statement. The only thing I can conclude from that was that there was, in fact, a trip to Austin in which the investigation file was turned over to the State Board of Insurance. The court will recall that what started this whole saga was an anonymous letter to the State Board of Insurance. And so what our people did is to turn over the entire investigation file, which, as you know, involved more than just Mr. Sears.
So that's all there is in the record to support that statement?
That's my understanding of what is in the record. Now, the Court of Appeals has put that interpretation on it, and I'm prepared to deal with that. But the point is that the entire investigation file, which involved Mr. Sears, and specifically involved Mr. Sears' concession at trial, that he did, in fact, participate in the inflation of a claim involving his cousin, Priest. That information was clearly turned over to the State Board of Insurance. Significantly, the State Board of Insurance did nothing.
Well, if there was evidence that they did more than simply turning over, there was evidence that they really did pursue getting his license revoked, if they had no interest to do that. Could that be some evidence of extreme and outrageous conduct?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, first of all, that that's what they were trying to do. They were clearly trying to turn it over to the State Board of Insurance to do whatever whatever the board wanted
to
do.
But the premise of my question was if they did more than that, and I mean, and actually took it a step further by trying to become active in getting his license revoked.
I really don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is, remember, we have an agent who has conceded under oath that he did, in fact, participate in an inflated claim. And part one of the persons involved in the inflated claim is a person who was, in fact, federally convicted of insurance fraud. So I would respectfully say no, that would not rise to the level of extreme and outrageous conduct. Now, we know that this whole saga began with the anonymous letter. We also know that Mr. Sears was terminated in October of 1990. It is important for this court to realize why he was terminated. He was terminated because of his involvement in two claims, the Willingham claim and the Priest claim.
But isn't that a fact question?
Your Honor, he conceded his involvement in both.
Well, he has conceded his involvement, but he also claims he was terminated because of some personal animosity that implicated him wrongfully in a kickback scheme. And I'm going to presume those two theories were argued to the jury, and that's a fact.
That's his claim, but you have to have evidence of it. And the evidence I would respectfully submit is undisputed that the reason he was terminated, remember, he was terminated before the investigation was concluded. He was terminated in October of 1990. One of the complaints the majority of the Court of Appeals level was that somehow things took place after his termination. Well, he was terminated once the information was learned about his involvement in these two claims. And so after that is when the investigation continued, primarily with respect to others, because he was essentially terminated.
Well, but you'd agree that there could be an argument that that was pretextual. I mean, I'd be surprised if they stood up and conceded that he was terminated because of those two claims.
Well,
are they going to do that?
I think you're right. I don't think they're going to concede it. But again, you've got to have evidence to say that somehow there was some evidence. And our position is that the evidence is that they were undisputed, and it is undisputed that he was terminated for the reasons I've indicated. Now let me turn to the at-will doctrine. The majority of the Court of Appeals, I think, got off on the wrong track because somehow they tried to divorce a pre-termination investigation from the termination itself. And they seem to say that you don't really need to do an investigation, but once you do an investigation, somehow you may assume certain responsibilities. We respectfully submit that almost any termination is going to involve some type of inquiry, even if it's just one question. There has to be some type of inquiry before the employer is going to make a decision about termination. And so our position is that the investigation, as small or minimal as it might be, is inextricably linked with the termination decision itself. And unfortunately, the Court of Appeals somehow divorced the two and says that, you know, you just fire anybody for any reason, which is absolutely accurate. But they then say, but if you do an investigation, you have an obligation to not do so in a negligent manner. And our position is that just totally emasculates or erodes the at-will doctrine. And let me give you an example. If an employer has this duty in Texas, an employer is essentially left with three decisions. One decision is to do an investigation, in which event you are suddenly subjected to the potential of civil liability for unreasonable or negligent investigation. Or two, you do no investigation at all. You get a letter to the State Board of Insurance, which is copied to you or you receive. You do no investigation at all because of the fear of this liability. And the risk is that you're terminating an absolutely innocent employee that an investigation would have revealed was innocent, but you're scared to death to do it because you're exposing yourself to liability. The third choice is that you either do or don't do an investigation, but you don't terminate the employee that might be implicated. Then you run the risk of litigation either by shareholders, investors, other interested third parties. So it's a situation that is almost a no-win situation for an employer, which I would respectfully submit is the very thing that the at-will doctrine is intended to prevent in the state of Texas. But if this court adopts a cause of action for negligent investigation of an employee prior to termination, we say that you are seriously eroding the employee at-will doctrine in the state of Texas.
The Court of Appeals tried to follow Berg versus WCW. Is that applicable here or inapplicable because of the at-will doctrine, or they misapplied it, or what's your view?
Your Honor, our position is, first of all, it is applicable, but they misapplied it. This court in the Byrd case and in earlier decisions, I mean, laid out the analysis that any court must apply before adopting some new cause of action. The one point I want to make is that Mr. Sears had a remedy in this case. For whatever his complaints are, he had a remedy. He had a slander cause of action, or a defamation cause of action, if you will, but unfortunately, they waited too late to file it, so limitations barred. They have an intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action. And we say, for the reasons in our brief, they didn't prove that. But he had a remedy. But I think, Justice Hack, that the problem with the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals is that they basically said that the foreseeability of the risk that an employee could lose his job somehow is what the court calls the foremost and dominant consideration. But this court has already held before that the mere fact that an at-will employee might lose his or her job is not a sufficient basis for creating, among other things, an intentional infliction of emotional distress cause of action. But in balancing, applying the Byrd test, they conceded that the social inequity, clearly, the social utility, rather, clearly is in favor of farm bureau. And they talk about, for example, it's important to be able to police your employees. They talk about how it's important to guard against fraud. They talk about how to lower premiums. They talk about you don't want to discourage investigations. But the one thing they never mentioned, was the effect on the at-will doctrine. The court just totally ignored that. So our position is that if the court properly applied the Byrd test and really did try to balance all these factors, that the balance would weigh very heavily in favor of a conclusion that there is no cause of action whatsoever. Now, I think there's another reason, Your Honor, why we're so concerned about this new rule. I mean, basically, this court has laid out various tort schemes with certain responsibilities. The adoption of this cause of action would actually create a lower threshold, or an easier right, if you will, for a disgruntled employee who justifiably believes that he was unfairly terminated to recover or to create a cause of action. Let me tell you what I mean. Slander or defamation has a one-year statute of limitations. If this court adopts a negligent hiring cause of action, that's probably a two-year statute of limitations. So in effect, the period for recovery is being, or for the filing is being lessened. In addition, malicious prosecution. If you've got an employer that is subject to a malicious prosecution claim, one of the things you have to show is malice, which is not easy to prove. But if you have a negligent hiring cause of action, why would you even allege malicious prosecution if there's any doubt about whether you can prove it? Let's go the easier route. Let's go ahead and file the negligent hiring case. And another reason why we think that it's bad policy for this court to adopt that is how in the world do you enforce it? If all you need to do is to look at the reasons that the Court of Appeals in this case used as a basis for saying that there was some evidence of negligent hiring here to show that the quagmire that you will be putting our courts in. For example, the Court of Appeals was talking about, well, certain questions may not have been asked. The employer may not have given certain weight to what certain people said. That there was a failure to supervise the investigator. An investigation is, by its very nature, subjective. And not only is the investigation subjective, but so too is the evaluation of the material produced in the investigation. So basically what you'll be asking the courts of Texas to do is to police an inherently subjective cause of action. Because the fact of the matter is that if there is such a cause of action in Texas, there will almost always be a situation, I would respectfully submit, where some fact issue somewhere can be created, either because you didn't talk to one particular witness, or you didn't talk to that witness long enough, or you never asked this question of that witness, or there are inconsistencies, and you shouldn't have come down in favor of witness A as opposed to witness B over here, so that you're invariably going to be in subjective situations.
Let me ask you, we have, I'm sure you're aware, another case pending, Mission Control, where the employer decided to do drug testing itself rather than sending it out to a lab. And there were allegations made that the testing procedures were negligent, and a report was made that an employee had taken drugs, or alcohol, I believe it was, when in fact they claimed they had not, was terminated, went into a national database, can never drive a truck again, are the allegations. Is there any way you can see, writing an opinion such as this, that we have out a situation like that one?
Yes, I think there's one very significant difference between our case and say, the Mission Petroleum case. First of all, there's no question that the respondent here had a remedy. At least as I read the Mission Petroleum case, there is a serious question about whether or not the employee in that case had a remedy because of the peculiarity of the regulations which governed drugs.
That's a difficult way to go, to see if they have another remedy, because we have problems there, and I can perceive problems here with whether they could ever prevail on a libel, slander, or malicious prosecution. So evaluating whether they would recover under alternate theories doesn't really help me much.
Well, but it's certainly an equitable consideration the court can consider when applying the Byrd analysis as to whether or not a person would ever have a cause of action under the peculiar circumstances of the case.
But can you think of another way to carve it out vis-a-vis the employer? And because in that case, the claim has been made that if there's any liability on the employer's part, it's going to be the end of at-will employment. But the employer there seemed to be wearing two hats. The employer was acting as an employer, but also as a drug tester. And
Your Honor, in that case, I guess one of the critical issues is the employer somehow taking off their employer hat and putting on a totally different hat? And that, in turn, requires an analysis of whether or not the activity complained of somehow is the typical type of employer activity that prevails. The problem with the case, from your perspective, the problem is that today, with the concern over drugs, you have employers that are becoming increasingly concerned about drug use on the job and the effect it might have on others to third parties. For example, if you have someone that owns a shoe store.
Oh, there's no question about that. I think the issue in Mission Petroleum or the Mission case was that they didn't send it to someone who could test properly, and therefore were they wearing the testing hat, which is, I'm having trouble with those concepts because you could argue here that the employer was wearing the investigation hat, but you would then draw the line at whether it's an inherently employer type.
Exactly, because I think I would say that the investigation of a complaint which was directed at an employee's alleged dishonesty would ordinarily be part of the typical employer process because you have an interest in making certain that your employees are honest and somehow adverse consequences are not being brought about with respect to the company. So, I mean, I think that is clearly an employer-related activity. Drugs may be one step removed, but again, at Mission Petroleum, and you're talking about truck drivers and potential use of drugs.
But again, that's not the issue as to whether to test for drugs.
Right.
It's who's going to do the testing. Because my understanding in that case was that there can be a duty from the drug testing company to perform the test reasonably, and that if the employer does the testing, should they then be excused because they're an employer? And that's a distinction, I think, that's going to be difficult.
Right. And I guess another point would be is wouldn't the employee have a cause of action? Let's say that the drug testing is done by an outside laboratory. Wouldn't the plaintiff have a cause of action against the laboratory?
Well, that's what my point exactly. I mean, by taking over that function, is the employer somehow excused from performing the duties that a lab would have by being an employer? And that's the difficulty, I think.
I understand the difference, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ron Atkinson will present argument for the respondent.
Please, Court, Your Honors, there are a couple of factual matters that need to be cleared up. I have been at the trial in this case and haven't tried this case. First of all, there is evidence in the record in the form of a reading of a deposition which included tape recorded transcript from the investigative file of this investigator and Mr. Calloway, who's an employee of Texas Farm Bureau. Of a face-to-face conversation they had with an insurance commission investigator where they continually goaded him to try to get him to revoke my client's license. This wasn't a sending of a file. Mr. Calloway, who's directly employed by the insurance company, and this investigator, who we'll talk about later, about his investigative technique, Calloway's involvement with it, went to the investigator, and over and over and over in this deposition, and over and over and over in this transcript that the jury heard, they were trying to get him to revoke his license, and he keeps saying, I don't see anything. And they say, yeah, look over here, he did this, he did that, and he handled this claim. And the investigator, I don't see anything. And I noticed this morning in the court's review of this case, which I understand is not the court's, but is an employee of the court, it says that after the company terminated Sears, it gave results in the investigation of several state and federal agencies. It didn't get the results in the investigation because the result of the investigation was also before the jury, and the investigator admitted he didn't have any evidence to tie Mr. Sears to any type of wrongdoing. What they took to the investigators after they had terminated this man, taken away his insurance benefit, canceled his renewals on the policies that he had written, and destroyed his life, was made up of perjured testimony of a two-time convicted child molester serving time in the penitentiary for a kickback scheme that my client had tried to report years earlier. They made it up.
With respect to the duty that the Court of Appeals found, it's hard to understand why they have a duty to investigate in a particular to a particular standard when they don't have to do one at all and they could have just fired him for no reason.
I understand this dichotomy, but I also, just as heck, I guess for years, it's been the rule in Texas and it's part of this balancing test under Byrd that once you undertake the activity, you may not have to do it. But once you undertake it, you have a general duty not to be negligent.
Well, the Court of Appeals rejected that. They said, we're not going to go that far.
And they went to the Byrd balancing test, and I don't see an undue influence in the Byrd balancing test. And let me preface all this by saying right off the bat, I think my client has remedied that he has proven under the intentional infliction of emotional distress argument. The Court of Appeals sends this back on a sufficiency on this duty issue, and I think that it's important in the context of jurisprudence in the state of Texas, perhaps. I think that they're all good duty on the facts of this case because it is so bad what they did. But if they had just fired him, lots of things wouldn't have happened. If they hadn't done this investigation, lots of things wouldn't have happened. He would have been dragged into a police, into his own office with police officers present and questioned and come out and have this investigator lie to him and say, Mr. Sears, the police don't believe that they're fixing to arrest you and haul you to jail. They would not have this investigator calling up his wife in the middle of the night and frightening her out of her wits. You wouldn't have this investigator down here running a witness off the road just so he can give her 24-hour protection and then getting into an illicit relationship with her and trying to turn her on Mr. Sears. If there hadn't been an investigation, you wouldn't have this investigator, Mr. Callaway, going to every other insurance agent in town and telling them that my client's a crook when he's not. If you hadn't had this investigation...
Well, let me just stop you on that point. Mr. Beck says that it's undisputed the reason he was terminated was because he had, another claim that was undisputedly inflated.
No. Let me tell you what the real evidence is. The real evidence is that after the fact, they come up with the priest's claim, which is his cousin. And when they say that he was involved in the claim, let me tell you what his involvement was. His involvement was that he called and said he turned the claim in for it. He went out and looked at the work that the contractor had done. But I want you to remember something. It's undisputed in this case. Insurance agents in the Farm Bureau system can't adjust claims over $500. They have absolutely no authority. On the Willingham claim, which was the other claim that they used, the same thing. It wasn't even his account. They had, I forgot what it was, a truck ran through the wall or something. And he went out, and here's what the man's guilty of. Having tried to turn in Mickey Walker and Don Lackey years ago and being told basically to go back to Nacogdoches and mind his own business by his own company. He committed the unpardonable sin of telling that woman, well, I'll tell you how it works. If you really want your house fixed, you're going to have to call, you might as well call Mickey Walker. Period. That's it. That's what he did.
There are two things you were saying. One, let's say we agree there's a duty to investigate without negligence. If that's so, but you also said that there is no requirement that an employer investigate at all. There's this at-will requirement. So if we decide that you're correct, would you, in advising employers, tell them, don't do investigations? Because if you do, if you even bother to determine whether an employee is innocent or guilty or honest or dishonest, then you could subject yourself to liability depending on how you conduct that investigation. Wouldn't that be the advice you'd give to all employers?
No, sir, I'll tell you the advice I'd give them. I'd say that you need to read the opinion of the Waco Court of Appeals and Sears, and you need to realize that the Waco Court says you don't have to give him a perfect investigation. And you don't have to give him a flawless investigation.
But any imperfection in an investigation would result in a jury trial.
No,
isn't that right?
No, sir, because it doesn't rise to the standard of negligence. The standard of negligence is doing something a person of ordinary prudence wouldn't do, or failing to do something that a person of ordinary prudence wouldn't do. And so the fact that your investigation may have conflicting stories, we're not in a conflicting story situation. Do you see my difference?
What if I'm an employer and I call in a woman who said that her coworker sexually harassed her? And I call them both and I sit them down and I say, tell me what happened. She gives her version, he gives hers. Yes, and I say, I don't believe either one of you, I'm going to fire you both. Now, that's my investigation.
I don't think you, A, I
and have to go, if, let me if I had gone and talked to coworkers, 10 out of 10 would have said he sexually harassed her, but I didn't do that. I just fired them both.
Under, because that is an investigation that you may have a duty to do under the sexual harassment laws, it's a little bit different.
Well, but answer the question this way. The same question, but it's theft of $10 out of the cash register.
I think you're in a situation you're not allowed to.
So there ought to be. So you're saying that there is an employer should be able to decide in advance that if there's any suspicion whatsoever with an employee's conduct, that without regard to an investigation, they could be terminated and they should be fired.
If they don't do the investigation, you can't touch it. That's what At Will's all about. That's what At Will says, but that's all At Will says.
So what you're telling us then is, as a policy matter, then employers shouldn't undertake investigations.
I think that right now, as the law exists, the safer course for an employer, and I have told employers this, is that don't investigate.
How's that good?
Well, it's where we find ourselves.
Well, maybe not, but I don't understand how it's good to not look at the facts and just say, well, you know, I wished I knew the truth, and I have to get at it, but rather than risk it, you're fired.
And I understand that, and certainly the evolution of our jurisprudence on that is an open question, I guess, for debate all day long. I think that's where we find ourselves today. What's better? Is there, if we change that, we've got to decide, is there a competing interest between the right of an employee to, if he's going to be investigated, not just have it be done shoddily?
But I guess I'd have to ask you the question, what is the difference between not asking a co-employee their information about a circumstance that is negligent investigation and making a decision that I'm not going to go ask the employee what that is and claim that's no investigation?
Well, the question is a little inopposite because the law clearly recognizes right now if you don't investigate, you don't have any problem. And
isn't the determination not to question witnesses as much a part of the type of investigation you do as it is to say it's not an investigation?
No, the law just flatly says it's not. It says no investigation means no investigation. Can't be held liable.
You ask the employee one question, is that an investigation?
No.
Well, I call in my employee and I say, tell me what happened. An employee explains to some detail what happened. And say, look, rather than go into who shot John, I'm just going to terminate. And had I gone, as Justice Enoch suggested, and interviewed employees, that employee's statement would have been backed up. Now, have I not undertaken an investigation by asking and then negligently not gone further and tried to find out was it true?
I think there's a difference between asking a question and conducting an investigation. And clearly under Texas law, it stands right now, the situation that you just posed, employer's not liable, and it won't be if you adopt the rule in this case.
But that's a major factor in this risk-utility analysis.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're posing that as that's the way it is, but you're wanting us to create a duty here, and in doing that, we've got to very seriously consider what we want employers to do, and why would we want employers not to investigate as a matter of public policy?
You ask me what I personally think the rule ought to be? I think the rule ought to be that the employer ought to have the right to investigate, which is a change from our law now without regard to having liability, but that there ought to be, held a reasonable man standard. And just that. And yes, it's going to be a case-by-case analysis. And yes, you're going to have people that are going to say...
But every case, then, is going to be in court. I mean, it could be.
Yeah.
It's always going to be a fact question. It's a matter of degree.
It could be, but I think that lawyers are not going around looking for cases of negligent investigation unless they're really egregious. Because we still, well, in all the way, still have the at-will employee status in Texas. And like I said, this part of the case... is only a part of the case as far as I'm concerned.
But you'd agree, it could pose a problem.
It could pose a problem. And
you agree the Court of Appeals did not take that into account in their risk utility analysis.
I think that they applied the Byrd factors strictly without regard to what the total jurisprudence of the state might be, but just looked at the duty issues enunciated in Byrd strictly. Which, if you think about it for a minute, is the job of the Intermediate Court of Appeals, and the job to look farther than that to total jurisprudence of, as I've always understood in the state, belongs more rightly to the Supreme Court.
On the intentional infliction part, is it utterly intolerable for somebody, for an employer, to talk to a regulatory agency about circumstances pertaining to their employee's license, insurance, or law, or medicine, in a way that says perhaps you should consider revoking his license?
Well, if you read that transcript, that's not what he's doing. But in the case where you are making it up, if I sit here in my notebook and I say I have absolutely no evidence to connect Sears to any wrongdoing, and I go to a regulator or I go to the IRS and I go to anybody and I sit there and tell them something completely different, knowing that's in my notebook, that's outrageous.
Let me ask you about that. If the regulator doesn't buy it, is there an intentional infliction of emotional distress?
It's not whether the regulator buys it, Your Honor. It's what does it do to your client when he gets a notice from the state insurance board that his license is in jeopardy, or when the IRS knocks on his door and says, because his two-time convicted child molester is now leaving this insurance company, has sent you a 1099, I'm going to try, you know, I'm going to see if you're going to go to jail for failing to pay your income
what's
taxes.
What's the evidence in this record? Best evidence from your standpoint as to what either the IRS or the insurance commission did that adversely affected your client?
Contacted him, and he knew that he was a subject of an investigation. Also, not only them, but also it was the Internal Revenue Service and also postal inspectors. He gets visits from postal inspectors. They show up.
How many visits?
I think it was two.
I want to focus also on the emotional distress. In addition to proving the outrageous act, you've got to prove severe mental anguish. In the petitioner's brief, they concede that although you outlined the economic consequences of the termination, you didn't describe in any detail the emotional reaction or mental anguish. And I've reviewed your brief yet again, and again I see the details of the consequences. Was there any evidence in the record of the severity of the emotional distress suffered by your client? What was that?
Well, I think as you can well imagine, visits by people carrying badges and toting guns and asking you direct questions about whether or not you violated federal laws is upsetting.
But did you have any evidence of medications, medical visits, anything of that nature?
There was some as to Ms. Sears. There was some as to Mr. Sears about the fact that it was hard to sleep. I think there was some discussion in there of the medications that he was on.
Prescribed as a result of any consequences of this act?
I don't know that there was medical testimony that made the link other than the totality of the circumstances and that it was after the fact of all of this coming up. But I don't think that's also required under the rule, and I don't know that point seriously is raised but in that context of the fact that you needed an expert to make that link, because in a mental anguish context, I think the cases we're talking about in the brief seem to say that once you raise what it was that went on, then it's up to the jury uniquely to decide what that is.
Justice Gray purported to quote the record on this subject. Justice Gray, in his dissent, purported to quote the record on the subject, and the majority did not take issue with that. And you, I don't recall that you have. He sets it out. Is that that's set out in his dissent, the extent of the evidence on
I don't believe it's complete, Justice Act. I really don't. I really don't. Because I recall very much what the testimony was from these folks.
Do these facts give rise to a malicious prosecution?
I never considered that. It's an honest answer.
What about slander?
Well, when the case got to me, slander was alleged, but it's the same thing Justice O'Neill said earlier. I don't know whether you can questions of whether you can prevail on different causes of action. I don't know. I think certainly with the insurance agents in town, there was probably some slander that went on. This was more than just your hypothetical about, well, I asked a couple of people.
Well, I understand. I'm saying based on what you said, the facts you recited, why wouldn't you have a malicious prosecution claim?
I think you could make the factors of a malicious prosecution claim in the case.
So why do
But we the problem with that is, in any malicious prosecution claim, that the people in this case that would have had to have supported that would have been other insurance agents in town. Now, the practical problem from a lawyer's standpoint is you don't have a real proof problem.
But aside from the proof, I'm just saying, looking at the facts that are alleged, I mean, we've never really, I'm not sure we've articulated this way, but we have not tended to expand intentional infliction of emotional distress into areas where there are well-established causes of action.
I really don't think that in this context that you're ever going to make a slander case. I don't think you're going to be successful making a slander case out of it. Because so much of what went on was internal.
But you're for a malicious prosecution, you're saying they falsely presented facts to investigating agencies who did investigate. And why wouldn't that give rise, if true, why would not that not give rise to a malicious prosecution claim?
Well, I don't think that the agencies very seriously considered this from the get-go. Some of these agents may have worked with Investigator Graham before. Some of them may have known this fellow Walker, who was, as their investigator, made quite a colorful character. So I don't know that the gravamen of malicious prosecution, which is that you actually get him prosecuted, actually occurred. What really happened was it's all internal. And after the fact, remember, all this takes place after they fired him. He's gone when they're doing all this. And what it was just an attempt to beat him down psychologically and to worry and upset him. They knew they couldn't get him prosecuted. But they knew they could make officers show up at his door and vex him and cause the types of problems that are in the record, and the sleeplessness and the anxiety and worry, the embarrassment of going to his church where he'd been for years, and how people know that agents have been in town looking for him.
Let me ask you about the libel slander piece. That would have been a difficult cause to prove, wouldn't it, because of the broad privilege that's recognized in that context?
Absolutely.
Well, then why shouldn't we allow an employer to have that sort of privilege in doing an investigation? Under general negligence, there is no privilege. Why do we grant such a broad privilege to employers in a libel slander context, but then just discard it completely in an investigation context?
I don't know. What this case really gets down to is that in this new era that we have of public policy and public expectation of accountability for major corporate decisions, is whether or not there's going to be standards. If you look at it one way, James Sears went and tried to point and did he committed a cardinal sin. He tried to point out that there were things wrong with the company. And for that, he specifically was targeted for retaliation of the very things that he had the audacity to point out the corporation was doing wrong and allowed him to be done wrong.
Would he have a whistleblower cause of action?
I don't think so on the facts of this case because of his status. They treat these guys as independent contractors.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
About independent contractors, I'm a little confused on exactly what an independent agent is, and even if I wasn't, is that a distinguishing factor between at will and the contract?
It's not, Your Honor, in this case, because at trial, both sides considered Mr. Sears to be in an at will relationship. His contract specifically says that either party may walk away from this. And the Court of Appeals, in fact, treated it the same way.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you, one of the footnotes in the Court of Appeals makes a distinction between what happened up until the time of termination and what happened after it, or I assume for purposes of when they're discussing the difference between the negligent investigation and what may have risen out of that, and what happened after termination when they had no relationship and when all of the efforts to get his license removed and the reports to the investigatory agencies.
Right. As I understand the majority's opinion, Your Honor, what they did is they just simply said employment ended in October. And then they started talking about in the opinion what took place after he was terminated and said that that's what is some evidence of this extreme and outrageous behavior, and that's what the court said justifies.
But would you agree with that concept that there is a difference between actions taken before and after termination?
I think in some instances there could be, Your Honor, but when the conduct after the termination really arises out of an investigation that took place during the employment, I would say that that's a distinction without a difference.
But his response to that is the totality of the investigation showed that he's not guilty of the claim asserted, that is, the kickback.
Well if there's no...
And it was their own investigator that they hired that reached that conclusion. So why isn't his claim of after termination that it was a vindictive effort to get Mr. Sears?
Well, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, we have a dispute about what the record shows and what it doesn't show. And
well, could we say then, but the jury resolved that?
No, I mean, that's because I say that the record is clear, but I'm saying we have a dispute. So, with respect to this effort to try to get his license revoked, let me refer the court to Volume 3, page 68 of the transcript, which specifically talks about how the investigation with respect to a number of people was turned over to the State Board of Insurance. Remember, this is the agency that regulates my client.
Well, I guess I'll ask the question. Were every one of those people turned over to the IRS, the postal authorities, whoever else?
The whole investigation was turned over to all those agencies because every one of those agencies had an interest. The IRS had an interest because it may be that somebody was not reporting income that they had received.
Well, did they ask Mr. Walker to give 1099s to everybody else in addition to Mr. Sears?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that. Another dispute we have with respect to this intentional infliction of emotional distress point is whether or not Mr. Sears, in fact, was guilty of inflating a claim. I don't want to go back and forth, but I'll simply refer the court to Volume 4, page 89 of the transcript, and also all the citations listed on page 6 of Petitioner's Brief, which I think supports the statement that I mentioned to the court. And as this court said in BFI versus Leak, the public policy of this state is that you turn over to regulatory authorities wrongdoing because we have an interest in making certain that our laws are enforced in the state of Texas. And this court went so far in that case as to say, even though that may cause some emotional distress to someone, that's a public policy statement that this court made in BFI versus Leak, a 1994 case. Let me turn now to the employee at will point.
Do you think there ought to then be an absolute privilege for reporting anything to an investigatory agency, even if you think it's baseless and we just trust them to sort that out?
Your Honor, if you think it's absolutely baseless and you know it's absolutely baseless, then I would question that broad statement. Because then I think you're really getting into an intentional infliction of emotional distress situation.
Right, now, why isn't the plaintiff's case taken favorably to them at this standpoint? Why doesn't that make out a case of IIED, at least on the liability part? We won't get to damages.
Because, Your Honor, I mean, even if you accept what they say is true, the cold, hard record shows that it was an insurance agent who was involved in the inflating of claims that was absolute wrongful under the procedures of the company. So here we have a situation that is documented in the record where he was involved with arguably two, but certainly an inflated claim with the very person that was convicted of fraud and also involved somebody who was indicted for fraud. And so we say that turning that information over to the State Board of Insurance, for example, when they ask for a response, when they want to know what my client is doing with respect to this, does not create a cause of action.
Mr. Atkinson presents an explanation for that, that that's the only way this claim is going to be processed under the corruption of that particular area of your company.
Well, there's another way it could have been processed. Is he could have walked into...
Do you think we have to get down to that level of wrestling through this record in order to find out if there is a claim for IIED? If the plaintiffs have made out a claim for intentional infliction of emotional distress, we have to get down to that level of wrestling with this record as to whether or not this statement he made was justified on the basis of State Farm's practices in the left.
I do not. I think you check the record to find out if there is any confirmed wrongdoing from Mr. Sears' own testimony. If that is the case, I think that's the extent of the investigation this court needs to do to confirm the point that I've made. Secondly, this court said in Diamond Shamrock versus Mendez, what is and what is not egregious conduct. And our position is that under the facts of this case, that the facts of this case are much more closely akin to Diamond Shamrock versus Mendez, where you had a defendant who was accused of actually going through the community accusing the plaintiff of being a thief. Which is essentially what I guess they're saying that they're arguing here. And this court held that as a matter of law, there was no cause of action under the intentional infliction of emotional distress. And then the third point, which I don't want to forget, under the intentional infliction of emotional distress, and that was the point that Your Honor raised, and that is there is no evidence in this record to confirm or to support the finding that there was the severe emotional distress that is required under that cause of action. Even the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals considered that evidence to be, as quote, sparse. Well, Your Honor, it's more or less, rather, than sparse.
Mr. Peck, before we started asking questions about the IIED claim, you were going to make a statement about employment at will. You had a point you wanted to make.
I want to make about employment at will is that one question can be an investigation. And what the employers of Texas need is a bright line test that they can follow. If following Justice Owens' hypothesis, if you call an employee in and you ask one question, I guarantee you there's going to be a creative lawyer who's going to say that you started an investigation. And the argument's going to be it was incomplete.
Okay, I just wanted to hear what the
point was. That was the point I wanted to make.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause and concludes the court's historic sitting today in Tyler. We very much appreciate Smith County Bar Association and the University of Texas at Tyler for their hospitality in this visit, and we look forward to visiting further with the students of Tyler after we make a preliminary discussion among ourselves about these cases. So will the marshal now please adjourn the court?
Oh yeah. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.